The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 15th of August, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals. And Lawrence provides a drilling update on their zinc lead silver project in Spain, in which a 12-meter section is showing significant visible signs of mineralization. Also on the podcast, I have Suresh Withana, Investment Manager at Adamas Finance Asia, ADAM, sticker there. And Suresh describes their investment selection process and strategy. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers GVC Holdings, First Group, Prudential, and Glenn Goodman, crypto trader and author, talks about Bitcoin and the world of crypto trading. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a raft of other content, including articles, videos, and podcasts. That's voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Lawrence Reed, Executive Director of Europa Metals. He's busy there typing away, posting videos of a recent drill hole, and we'll get into that in a bit. Lawrence, but before you start, you're quite happy with the news so far in summary of the drill, the results you've got so far?
Yes, I am. I mean, I think this is an exciting drill hole, but we need to take the campaign as a whole. So, you know, let's recap on the news so far. So, yeah, the first hole deviated, first hole into this deep high-grade area, the lead-zinc-silver core of Taral.
Let's back up because I want to get this. Because if people are new to this and they're not familiar with Europa too much, they want the full story here, and this is obviously currently what's happening. So let's reverse a bit, just for people not familiar with Europa, just give them overview of the company, if you could, Lawrence.
We've got what we think is a significant high-grade lead-zinc-silver project. We've got a scoping study on it. We did an awful lot of work using historic data with the maiden jolt resource announced last year. And now what we're doing is we're actually drilling into what we think is the high-grade centre to make sure that we can build a sustainable mine. And in addition to the drilling campaign, we've also last week, started engaging formally with all stakeholders in Castilla and León to look at progressing into an exploitation permit.
Yeah, and this is what you call drill hole 3, TOD 23. You commenced on the 8th of July, it's now been completed. So, give us a summary. What do you know? As you know, all this has to go off, doesn't it, be assayed? But what do you know so far from this, Lawrence?
Well, what we did, if you remember, on the third hole, is that once we successfully drilled, we could drill at depth on the second hole. After the first deviation, we looked at the absolute choice target areas, and the technical team always had this particular area in place. The area has lots of other fully assayed holes in the Jolt resource, which you can go and have a look at those grades in a RNS statement. So what we did is fundamentally say, right, where are the holes? Where can we drill into this to look at adding indicated and pulling an all-important metallurgical sample? So that's the postcode we went to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're happy with it?
Extremely happy with it. It was a massive relief. I got sent the photos by Miles, and just seeing the pictures of the live core. And you talked about videos at the beginning, but we thought it was actually the guys on site wanted to do a bit of a video, and we actually thought we'd show you the live core coming out of that, coming out with the 12 meter intersection. And just to see all of that lead, zinc, silver ore so visibly apparent there over such a long intersection. We've got to get it assayed there. We've got to put all the assays together, and you've got to consider them as a group. And then they'll be put out to joint reporting standards. So let's just be absolutely clear on that. That's absolutely essential. And the target remains to have an independently assayed reported JORC update, looking at first indicated, which is incredibly important to developing this mine, developing this project, and pulling the metallurgical sample to look at what can we sell, and what's the process flow sheet going to be. So those are absolutely key things that are coming up. But what we've seen come out of the drill core, plus the fact that we also got two surprise intersections, which is great, but also we've got to be quite careful. We've got to think very carefully about how what those two additional intersections mean up hole for the entire model, because drill does tend to surprise us, and so far it's tended to surprise us with grade being apparent where we didn't necessarily think it was, and sometimes higher levels if you think about last year's drill campaign. But so we're building the model up, but as one of the geo team said last week, end of last week when we were discussing this, you know, it is natural because we're actually really progressing this project and we're building up more and more data points. So it's natural that more and more questions come up. And it's not a bad set of data points to have, which is two additional intersections, but it's all got to be assayed, it's all got to be sent up. But the decision was very clearly taken that given the nature of this hole, that we needed to immediately commence with a daughter hole. And the video I talked about has the live logs of the 12 meters, but it also has a bit from Jesus, who was on site commencing the daughter hole.
Yeah, yeah. And Alexa, I'm just looking now at that picture. By the way, I mean, I think the market's liking it. You're hitting average daily volume already within first 10 minutes of market open, so that's a decent uplift. The share price is up. So yeah, you've got the picture there. I'm seeing now drill hole TOD complete with major intersection visible mineralization 12 meters. So you're obviously very happy that, like you say, you have to do assays and that. But so time wise, take us through how long is it going to happen? How long do assays take, and how long will we have results from that?
Well, I think we will complete the assays are being processed. So in other words, this is fresh, sort of hot off the press news, Justin. So the assays are being processed and will be sent off to sample. I don't want to put a very fixed time frame on, but we'd be hoping for an update on the assays and the JORC resource itself by the end of Q3 or very early Q4. And then the MET sample takes longer, a bit longer. So once we've finished pulling, because we've got this intersection, we're also looking at this daughter hole, pulling more MET sample, sending that off. So you'll have probably the MET results after the JORC assay results is the chronology. And then we'll also see what's happening in this daughter hole. And then there's a few other things we're doing at the moment, which may well be on the horizon. Things we'll be doing, which may not seem tremendously important, but we'll be launching a Spanish stakeholder website and giving you some updates over what we're doing in terms of ticking the boxes in with Castilla and León and our local community in terms of actually getting this mine ready.
Marvellous stuff. Lawrence, one final thing. As always, if someone's liking this, liking the sound of this, liking the pictures and the videos, but not yet following the story, please give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
I think Europe and Spain especially is a great destination for mines at the moment in an increasingly sort of unstable geopolitical world. I think zinc is a very exciting metal. For the good of the bad, it's been going up and down, but I think it will, if you look at, well, go and look at the forecast yourself, go and do your own, go and do your own homework. I think availability of decent concentrates in politically stable areas with supply chain transparency is important. But we've also got, I think, highly sustainable economics. So we're not just existing on the sort of lowest, you know, highest levels of zinc equivalent. We're saying, no, we want a decent project with longevity. And if we want to go and build this, if somebody wants to buy this project and go and build it, that you can literally just come and do that. They don't have to come in and build the power station and build the railway line and build the smelter and build the road and build the camp. We have tier one infrastructure, and we are in a traditional mining region, a traditional lead zinc region.
Marvellous stuff, Lawrence. Good to chat to you, and I look forward to more updates in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Suresh Withana, Investment Manager at Adamas Finance Asia. That's ADAM ticker. Suresh, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, first time you've been on the podcast, but I do this for all companies. So before we dig in to a bit of the under the hood and the workings of the company there, could you just please, you know, give a brief summary as to what you know, the company's all about, please?
Oh, yeah, happy to. I mean, Adamas Finance Asia is AIM-listed. It's one of the only investment companies that focuses on Asia. You know, our remit is really to look across Asia for opportunities in the SME space, the small and medium enterprise sector. So very similar to the UK and elsewhere in the world, SMEs in Asia are starved of capital. There's a massive financing gap there. In fact, the IFC have estimated it as $2.7 trillion. And so we're one of the only London-listed vehicles that actually targets that sector specifically, looking for opportunities to finance companies that are looking to grow, but are finding it hard to raise that money from traditional sources like banks and the capital markets.
Absolutely. Okay. And when you say Asia, is it certain regions of Asia, or are you looking all over?
No, we look at pretty much, you know, in the West, from all the way from India all the way to sort of China and up north to Japan and down south to Australia. So, you know, Asia is our playground. We're not focused on any one country in particular, because this phenomenon of SMEs finding it hard to raise money is actually a pan-Asian issue. It's not confined to any one particular country.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you find these investments? What resources do you use?
Well, I mean, we have a whole team on the ground. We have three offices, actually, Harmony Capital. I'm the managing partner for the business, and we're the investment manager, actually, for Adamas Finance Asia. So Harmony Capital has three offices, which I manage, which are based in Hong Kong, Singapore, and London. We have a team on the ground in Asia. I've spent most of my working career, actually, out in Asia as well, even though I call London home now. So we're well-known in Asia, particularly in the SME space. So a lot of our opportunities are just coming through referrals, through contacts, through our own network. And given that Adamas Finance Asia is listed, we also have a public profile, so people hear about us and contact us. So actually finding good opportunities is not a problem at the moment, given the vast opportunity that's out there.
Okay, excellent. And give us, I mean, you know, take us through the criteria a company has to meet for you to invest in them.
I mean, I'd probably answer it in a slightly different way. There are probably criteria that we look for where we won't invest, if I can answer it that way.
Yeah.
You know, so SMEs generally are a very big, you know, very big pool of opportunities. They can raise, you know, range from companies between 5 to 500 million in enterprise value. Yeah. But generally, the kind of companies we look for are companies that are particularly not startups. We're not a venture capital fund, for example. So, you know, we're not looking for companies with, someone with a good idea. We're usually looking for companies that are already generating revenues, usually profitable, typically have hard assets, you know, factories, buildings, sometimes, in their balance sheet. We're looking for good management, because at the end of the day, we don't want to own these companies. We don't want to run these companies. We want to finance them, but we're backing management. So we spend a lot of time on who runs these businesses. We also look for companies that are open to governance, meaning that, you know, they allow us to have a seat on their board, for example. Typically, if the companies don't want to do that, that's a red flag for us. So there's a number of things we look for which makes us walk away from companies. But other than that, we're very opportunistic. We'll look in any sector. We'll look, as I said, across Asia and really filter out what we think are the best opportunities for the portfolio.
Yeah, I like that, focusing on people first. I do some bi-weekly videos on companies I invest in, and I say at the end of the day, it does come down to people, doesn't it, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, in a lot of the companies we've invested in our pipeline, we've taken, in some cases, 3 months to 12 months of due diligence and just, engaging with them because, again, it's about getting to know the people. It's about getting to know the management. It's about getting to know the boards. It's about getting to know even the sort of layer below management as we spend time with these companies. And if we get a bad sense for whatever reason, then typically we walk away. And often, as I said earlier, if companies are not willing to do certain things, including being transparent and being open about, their financial statements, how they run their business, access to people in the company, those all tend to be red flags for us. And we do tend to walk away when we see those.
Yeah, there was a quote I saw recently, quite good actually. It says, a very good idea can be turned into a bad idea by bad management. And an ordinary idea can be made excellent by good management.
That's very true.
Yeah, yeah. So when you look at these companies, you look to put money in and say the management are good. Do you have any sector focus at all, or you don't care?
I mean, we are, purposefully agnostic because Asia is just such a brilliant opportunity, just generally as a region. And obviously, as you know, it's the growth engine of the world. There's so many great, exciting opportunities out there. But so we're sector agnostic. Having said that, when I look at the pipeline that we're looking at, for example, and even some of the investments we've historically made, they tend to sort of come from industries like healthcare, consumer-related industries, leisure and travel. And that shouldn't surprise anyone because, Asia is an aspirational society. It's got a vast middle class, and it's a very quickly growing middle class. So, these sectors tend to provide opportunities because that's where all the exciting growth typically comes from, and that tends to attract investors. It also tends to attract good ideas and good companies.
Mm-hmm. And what about, as far as, say, China? Do you have any companies at the moment in China?
Yes, I mean, historically, we've been a China-only focused company since mm-hmm. Harmony Capital took over managing Adamas Finance Asia. We have reduced our exposure to China. In fact, our exposure to China is less than 50% almost of our portfolio now. And, we continue to look outside of China only because there's so many other opportunities, as I said, across Asia. So, we don't exclude any particular part of Asia because we're a truly pan-Asian investment company. But that being said, we see so many other good risk-reward opportunities in the region where, I would say that most of our pipeline right now is really sort of focused on Southeast Asia, Australasia, and even some parts of North Asia at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And I was referring to China there because some people said, sometimes there's problems with transparency in China. Do you find that an issue or not?
I mean, I would say over my career, particularly focused on Asia, that, transparency is an issue no matter where you go. I don't think it's a China-only problem. I don't think it's India-only problem or Indonesia-only problem. I think generally in the SME sector, generally, you do find that these smaller companies sometimes, they're not used to being scrutinized by external investors like ourselves or professional investors. So therefore, they tend to resist. And as I said earlier on, that's a red flag to us. If they're open, and of course, you find plenty of companies that are very transparent, very professionally run, keep proper accounts, etc. So we tend to gravitate towards those kind of companies very quickly. So I would say that, the issue of transparency perhaps has gotten, a lot of press, or maybe negative press when it comes to countries like China. But actually, I see it across the region. My team sees it across the region. And we know what to look for in terms of screening those out very quickly.
Yeah, and as far as, exiting companies, what's your exit here? What's your process there? What do you do? What are you looking for? What's your target?
Well, because we're not investing in companies as a shareholder, so typical private equity investor buys a stake in a company, then hopes that company gets bought out by a competitor or listed or something like that. I mean, typically we're financing these companies. So usually we either lend money to the company, usually at very attractive rates, or we invest in the form of, let's say, a convertible bond or something like that. So we're not really a typical equity investor. So what I like to use is, it sounds like a fancy term, but it's basically their self-liquidating investments, meaning that they inherently have a structure which enables us to get our capital back, either by being repaid by the company, being refinanced by the company, or some kind of method like that. So we're not really that dependent on these companies, being bought by a competitor or necessarily going to an IPO or whatever. So that's how we tend to structure our investments.
I see. And give us an example of one of the companies you've recently invested in, if you could, Suresh.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. We've made an announcement recently. We invested capital in a developer who's developing a very exciting project in Niseko on the island of Hokkaido. This is in Japan. Niseko is a ski resort, a very well-known ski resort. In fact, it's one of the top 10 ski resorts in the world now. And this developer, who's based in Hong Kong, developing something in Japan, just found it very difficult to raise some financing from banks in both Japan and Hong Kong because they were raising a small amount of money, $4 million. They also had tapped out essentially a number of their shareholders who had provided a lot of money in the past. So when they came along to us, they invested, you know, we invested in them through a loan. We took security in the land and buildings in Japan. We have a registered mortgage. We've also got a very high coupon on that debt because, you know, we're getting a very attractive return. In fact, it's close to 17.5% return. And you know, the developer is happy to take that capital at that price because, as I said, they kind of fall between two stools. They can't quite get the money from the banks. They can't get the money from the capital markets. And so it's people like us that provide that financing going forward. So that was a very exciting opportunity. We're very happy with that investment.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent stuff. Okay, one final thing for you to do here, Serge, if you could.
Yeah.
Every time in the podcast, I'll highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets platform. So Okay. Could you, if someone's listening to this and likes the sound of this, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please?
I'd be happy to. I'd say the number one reason is because we're trading at a very significant discount to our net asset value, our audited net asset value. So I think that's worthy of looking at very closely. You know, we as an investment manager and as a company have a long track record in Asia. So I'd like to think we know what we're doing when it comes to focusing on Pan-Asian investment. And thirdly, as a vehicle, Adamas Finance Asia, as I said early on, it's one of the only vehicles that I'm aware of that focuses on this massive opportunity in the SME space that's also listed, you know, by listed in London. So hopefully your followers can start taking a look at us, or at least tracking us going forward.
Excellent stuff. Suresh, thanks very much for that, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
I look forward to it, Justin. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You're right, Chris?
Very good, thanks. Very good.
Oh, do you know what? I mean, you spend obviously the majority of time at the bigger end, bigger market cap size of the spectrum there of the market. And I know yesterday was, I think, the worst day since December in the US markets. It was the worst day for the Dow since December, I think, 4th or 3rd or early December. So, and that was a global sell-off. And yesterday, all major averages in America were down about 3%. We got the inversion, you know, of the bond yield curve there. But what's the markets like this morning and the bigger move, the bigger stocks today?
Is it? Yeah, it's slightly the calm after the storm, if that's an expression. And you're right. And markets yesterday were mixed up. I mean, the inversion of the yield curve, which, you know, is a very technical thing, but basically means that, you know, long-term bond yields and rates are actually lower than some of the shorter-term stuff, which obviously doesn't make much sense, and obviously it indicates huge pessimism. You know, that really impacted people's thoughts and people's perceptions towards the market, and hence what do? They buy gold, they chase more bonds further up, and they sell equities, and that's what you saw. And obviously, you know, various other issues, be it riots in Hong Kong or Kashmir or other things, everything suddenly glass half empty rather than, you know, glass half full or so. So, you know, large cap stocks were impacted. But, you know, today, Thursday, the shares are slightly up. Asia wasn't too bad. European markets, UK markets are slightly up. There's a little bit of calm again. I think a realization that yield curve inversion doesn't necessarily mean we're inexorably heading towards recession. You know, there are things that policymakers can do, and it's not just cutting interest rates and stuff like that, but it's also, you know, sorting out things like world trade, you know, making sure you don't have a trade war, or in the case of, let's say, a Hong Kong or a Kashmir, a descent into greater social or political anarchy or something. You know, many of these things, I think, are quite doable. Compromises can be reached. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the inexorable Brexit question, which, of course, is influential for any UK-facing matter. So policymakers can still do stuff, but there's certainly a switch, and there has been a switch from glass half full, which has been much of this year, year to glass half empty, and suddenly everything looks bad. And obviously for an investor, you've got to try and take that emotion out of it and look at things a little bit more, take a step back, look at it a little bit more fundamentally, think, hang on, actually, are some of these new fears, these new risks, these new slides and shares, are they valid or not? Or actually, is there more of an opportunity? And I have to say, you know, have I been making a few purchases this week in the midst of all the excitements and downward moves? The answer is yes, because I think that as an investor is what you've got to do. Keep a bit of cash back for times when there is blood on the streets or lurid headlines or other stuff.
Yeah, and I think it comes down, doesn't it, to valuation sometimes. You just got to look at, you know, if a stock is highly valued, okay, on a pullback correction, it's going to drop a lot, you know. But if you are buying companies and literally they are good value, you know, and you think, well, hang on, I don't think what's going to happen is going to affect the business, you know, and they are, you know, improving this. I mean, especially for larger companies, if their profit is improving, their earnings per share is improving, if their dividends are going to increase, then, you know, dips are an opportunity, aren't they? You know, and I even think on a macro level, we saw Trump blink a bit because, you know, his yardstick is the stock market, and he sort of champions it when it's highs, and he realizes it's tanking a bit on pretty much his tweets, you know, saying they're going to step up these tariffs, and everyone knows it's not good for global growth, and people are worried about that already. So I think he's blinked a little bit, and I think you will start to see maybe the Fed easing. So you know, it's going to happen, I think. And like I said, do you know what that's the inverted the 2-10 year in, you know, yield, that inversion. It's been quite accurate, but there's been times it's done that and it hasn't. You know, recession hasn't happened. And let's be honest, a recession, there are numbers when it comes down to it. I mean, there are a contraction, I know, it's a minus thing, but I mean, people will notice a massive difference. It's more sentiment, the sell-off. And it takes, on average, 18 months after that happens. 18 months. There'll be rallies. And I said in a video last night, I said, listen, we will have several rallies between now and if a recession happens, if it happens, where people will be saying, hang on, do you remember people were talking about global growth? What a lot of nonsense. People, like I say, a flip of a coin, sentiment turns on a flip of a coin. People will go from bearish to bullish. When the stock market rallies, everyone's bullish. And when it starts coming down, everyone's bearish. And really, to be a good investor, you have to flip that on his head and really be That's bullish. Because, right. You know, risk gets worse when the stock market's very high. You know, the risk is high when the stock market's high. Risk is low and it's very low because valuations are low. So,
that's it. It's exciting times, and you know, there's a very big fund management survey out, you know, which, you know, probably polls trillions of assets of run by fund managers. And guess what their top holding is? Their top holding is cash. I mean, their top holding is cash in terms of sort of overweights versus the norm, and their biggest underweight were equities. So, you know, that is tremendously risk off already. And the way to look at such things is just as you say, Justin, is to sort of think about it at the next iteration. You know, what's going to happen next? If you're already holding a bunch of cash as a professional fund manager, what are you going to do next? Maybe this is radical thought, maybe you might put some of it back into the market. We all know markets look forward, so as you say, it's a question of balance. You know, understand what you're investing in, why, understand the business they're in, how it could be impacted by lower growth or other disruptions, but also acknowledge that the stock market is a discounting mechanism and anticipates things, and that's what we're seeing at the moment. We're anticipating where we might be going, and we might get there, and if we do, maybe then will people start thinking about something else, or maybe we won't get there. You know, that's the wonderful game of the stock market. So sentiment matters hugely, I think keeping your head and not kind of being swayed aggressively, you know, thinking for yourself, thinking, you know, as you say, fundamentally, but also at a sort of a psychological level, thinking, well, hang on, if everybody else is panicking, then maybe it's time to go the other way is also a wise sort of feeling. As the great Warren Buffett says, you know, one of the greatest stock market expressions, which he pinched from his great mentor, Benjamin Graham, actually, you've got to be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy. That is so unbelievably true.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's have a look at some individual stocks, Chris. What's happening there? Any news?
A few things. We've got GVC, the big betting company, obviously owner now of Ladbrokes and Coral, obviously huge online as well, many, many countries around the world. They came out with some intro numbers today, looked good. They actually upped their earnings expectations, well, their EBITDA earnings expectations to be precise. They basically said that online growth is still good. I think they had 17% growth in online. online. Clearly, things such as physical betting shops are still difficult. But they said that actually some of the changes that you've seen, things such as the those betting machines being clamped down upon a little bit, some of that's been offset by better and stronger online performance. So net-net, this is why they've pushed up their earnings hopes. There's also a little couple of other things in their release. First is that the interim dividend was up 10% odd, which I think is actually a pretty good thing because it indicates continued good cash flow generation from the business. And the other aspect is they're very, very excited still about the US. Now, it's amazing to say that sports betting in particular is really behind the curve in the States for various historic, regulatory and other reasons, but it is liberalizing slowly. And most of the big UK betting names, you know, the William Hill, the Paddy Power, Betfair, Flutter as they're now called, and GVC, they're all over there trying to get a slice of the emerging cake. That seems to be going well. They're excited about apparently the new NFL season, which if I recall is American football. Which starts soon, and they think, you know, there's going to be a lot more betting as liberalisation occurs there. They think they're well positioned. So net-net, shares are up a little bit today. They've had a shocker, relatively speaking, year to date, because of course you have the CEO and the chair, I think stupidly, selling a bunch of their shares just days after the full year results back in March, and they dumped those shares at 666p, the old number of the beast, and you know, the shares really have struggled since then. But actually I think this one is good despite all those issues. I'm heartened by today's announcement, and I think it's a buy.
Marvellous stuff. Cool, anything else, Chris?
Well, apart from them, small announcement from First Group. Actually, you've had announcements on successive days from First Group. Yesterday, they announced that they'd won the franchise with their JV partner for the West Coast Mainline. And I think this is probably a good franchise to win. I know it very well. It's obviously Stagecoach and Virgin have run it for 22 years now. But as from, I think it's the 8th or 9th of December, you're going to have a new consortia headed by First Group who are going to run it. I think this is a good one to win. It's actually quite a modern franchise. I think they'll make a little bit of money from it, and overall good for publicity and PR and perception towards the shares. So I think that's good. That's been supplemented today by the announcement that they've appointed a new chair to the business. Now, you recall that First Group's been under activist attack. They turned down, I think stupidly, 120 pence bid from an activist investor, sort of a private equity investor last year. They've had another activist private equity type on their shareholder register recently agitating for change, and the company's starting to respond to that. They're talking about selling off underperforming areas, maybe trying to split the business a bit to show value. They've got lots of assets in buses in the States and other areas. But I think also there was some thoughts that they needed also to continue upgrading the management team. The guys, the CEO that turned down the private equity bid a year plus ago has gone. He's been replaced. And now the chair's going as well. He's been replaced by a guy who used to be in charge of Arriva, which is obviously another one of their rough sort of sector transportation peers. So I think all good news here. The shares responded well to it, and ironically are back to that sort of circa 120p where they turned down that bid, you know, 17, 18 months ago. So it's been a funny old run for shareholders. I have liked this stock year to date. It's been a really good performer. I think we're moving towards closer towards the end game here, but I think actually they're making all the right moves and the share is too cheap. Things like winning the West Coast franchise, continue to deleverage, these are still all ticks in the box. There's a fairer value for First Group shares, you know, 10, 20p higher than this. So I'm still a holder here and liking the announcements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just said that lost 18 months where the share price now just climbed back up to that offer price. Did they pay dividends there? I'm just thinking for long-standing shareholders, would they have got some awesome return?
No, they didn't, because of course the First Group's problem has been debt. You know, if you look back, big picture, the big issue has been too much debt. They built the franchises and ultimately wasted a lot of money just pushed debt levels up to unsustainable levels. So what the last two management teams have been doing is deleveraging. So no dividends, but debt reduction, bond refinancing and the like. So no, it's been a right old slap in the face for investors, to be honest. But what it did create, sort of, let's say, you know, the start of this year or a year ago or something, a great opportunity for new investors to come in. And as I said, they've got a new activist on the shareholder register who's agitated for change, has made some money off the shares, and I think actually in the wider scheme of things will be quite happy with how things are working out.
Mm-hmm, a lot of stuff. Anything else going on, Chris?
Final quick one is the Prudential. They came out with a quick announcement on Wednesday where they said they confirmed they were splitting their fund management business, M&G, from the rest of the group. You recall that Pru's got, it's not so much the man from the Pru anymore. They've got the fund management arm, M&G. Yes, they do have a UK business. They have a US life business as well. But the real growth's in Asia for this business, and they've got a fantastic market position there. So I think what they're trying to do is effectively focus people in a little bit more on the sort of the options, if you like, or the potential in their international business, both in Asia and the States and elsewhere in the world too. And I think splitting off the fund management arm, they feel, is a way where they can sort of highlight that a bit better. I think it's an all right strategy. I quite like it. The Prus, so well positioned longer term, has got an interesting corporate event coming up in terms of this split. The shares are sort of lurking in the mid 14 quid area at the moment, sort of near the sort of the lows for the last year or so. I would say this is an all right medium term pickup. This is the sort of good franchise business you want to kind of be involved with over the medium term. And you know, just because of what I'm seeing in terms of their potential to grow in Asia, is on its own is good enough. And certainly when I benchmark it against some of their peers who are also centered in Asia or based in Asia, I think the Prus got a very good position for many historic reasons, but they seem to be executing on it. So, you know, again, it's an indication the FTSE 100, it might be UK listed, it might be pushed around by Brexit issues and other stuff, but you've got a bunch of companies in there that have got a bunch of very interesting international exposures. The Prus, one of those. My feeling is here on a bad day, 14 and change quid, not a bad position to be thinking about initiating.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I was going to say, what's in the last, you know, couple of sessions, last couple of weeks, it's really had a sell-off, and the chart is the RS, or relative strength index, is at 20 or 21 now. Oversold, yes. Is 30 or below, and it literally it you'll see this on this chart. It happens once or twice a year, if that gets sold off like this. So it's had a major sell-off at the moment. The last sell-off in December, the global sell-off, it hits, what, 13.5 quid. Now it's at 14.43. It's not far off that. But
no, that's right.
Yes. And I think big sell-off is what? Why was that?
Yeah, you've got a few things going on here. I mean, the double pincer movement would be anything which has fund management exposure or even insurance exposure tends to get hurt in a market sell-off. You know, you look at something like Aviva, for example, bit less geared towards it, but still impacted by it. People worry about, you know, insurance portfolios and the like. The curveball for the Pru, the positive is the split. The negative would be, in Asia, of course, they're focused to make good money out of Hong Kong. And so if you see Hong Kong on the news in terms of excitements and other debates and issues, okay, and riots, yeah. Whatever else, you know, that's going to overhang it too. So I think it's sort of a pincer movement between the classic sort of market-led sell-off for these sort of insurance fund management type businesses, aligned with a little bit of, oh my goodness, you know, we've got to reduce. You know, you look at something like HSBC, for example. HSBC is very similar. You know, okay, the results there weren't that great recently. They're changing their CEO as well, but exactly the same phenomena. You know, the Pru's got a Hong Kong listing. You can bet some people have been selling, etc. You know, you can sort of pull that together with it as well.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff. Cheers, Chris. And, you know, I pretty much guarantee, if not the next time we speak, the time after, the markets won't be as bearish. It's amazing how it's a lot about the mind, isn't it? It's amazing. Like I don't know how many times you've gone through corrections or bear markets
too
or
many,
recessions.
Too many.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And at the time, it does seem like the end of the world. And then all of a sudden, I even forget the previous sell-offs. Like in December, I have to keep looking at the charts, thinking, what happened there? Oh, the sell-off. Yeah. At the time, it seemed like a big deal, but literally, it's nothing more than the bump in the road when you get a bit of distance on it, a bit of perspective.
Be greedy when others are fearful. That's the key.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Chris, speak next week, fella.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is author of The Crypto Trader. It's Glenn Goodman. I have to look to my right when I say that, Glenn, because I've got your book right there. So
my book's always your right-hand man at all times.
Exactly. And you've been on holidays. You've been telling me about Madeira. I went there years ago with my eldest son when my youngest son wasn't born. But it was quite nice, I think. But you just tell me how reasonable the food was in a sandwich shop and an evening meal. Situation, is that right?
Everything in Madeira is a lot cheaper than everywhere else. That was the amazing thing to me. I didn't realize it when I booked it.
It's odd, isn't it? It's called Madeira. So it used to be Madeira. And then it should be called Machipa.
Exactly, and people don't think of it that way as well. People kept going, "Ooh, Madeira," as if they thought it sounded vaguely posh or something. Yeah. But would you recommend it? Oh yeah. Well. Yeah, I would, absolutely. I mean, it's quite a quiet place. If you want a kind of nice, peaceful holiday with not too many crazy kids running around, well, apart from mine were probably the loudest in the whole island, I'd say it was my kids. But it was generally, like I say, the great thing about it, because obviously Europe is so expensive now with the pound being low, Madeira is kind of the exception to that. Everything is much, much cheaper than you would expect, but the quality is high. So there you go. That's my recommendation.
People are already tuning in thinking, what's this got to do with cryptocurrency? the exchange rate would have been fine if you just bought everything in Bitcoin. I mean, is there any way you can use Bitcoin these days? I mean, is it possible to use Bitcoin anyway?
If you go to Silicon Valley and sort of hang around the trendy cafes there, you can play with Bitcoin. But other than that, no, in Madeira, Bitcoin's utterly useless. I mean, I still see it as an investment tool, an investment asset, as with all cryptocurrencies. I'm in it for the trading. I'm in it to make money out of it. I'm not in it because I want it to be a payment mechanism. We've got to remember that the main use case in inverted commas for Bitcoin in recent years has shifted from the idea of it being a universal payment mechanism to now just a what they call a store of value, like gold.
That's it. It's becoming that, isn't it? But do you know what I think? By the way, one more fact about Madeira. Cristiano Ronaldo was born there. That's his home place.
Yeah, I noticed on the airport. Yeah. They haven't officially changed the name of the airport, so it still has Aeroporto, whatever, written on the top. But they've just slapped a massive photo of Cristiano Ronaldo onto the airport.
I had problems with his first name as well. It's Cristiano. I couldn't think of what it's. I was thinking, is it just Christian? It's just a flashy Cristiano. If we have another kid, I think I'm going to call him Cristiano. I quite like that.
Everyone will just think that you're a massive football fan.
Yeah,
or are you?
Or I'll call him Bitcoin.
that's the name for my next kid, Crypto
Ronaldo. That'd be a good name for you.
For one
of the avatars you see on Twitter, Crypto Ronaldo. Okay, so do you know what? This is my thought. It's become now a store value of like I said, it's an asset like gold, and it has been rallying. But as we talk, it's below 10,000, isn't it? 10,000 at the moment. But
it is.
This is my thought. Bitcoin trading or crypto trading, it's massive in the Far East, isn't it? You get so many sort of Chinese and Koreans up all hours, bleary-eyed and fevered mind, just trading like crazy loons. But it's very hard to get money out of China, actual money, proper money,
It is.
And I'm suspecting that the recent rally sort of coincides with these Hong Kong protests. And I'm thinking, do you think that's people trading Bitcoin, buying it to transfer their money, try and get it out of China easily? Because it's, I've had shares in companies who've had operations in China, and it always takes longer to get money out of China because they're very careful about their currency and they don't want people selling their currency. That's the trouble.
Your theory has got empirical backing. I'm pleased to tell you, actually. Yeah. In the sense that the price of Bitcoin has been trading at a premium in Hong Kong recently. And obviously with international arbitrage and so on, you wouldn't expect the price of Bitcoin to be different anywhere in the world from anywhere else. But obviously, if you have a temporary massive surge in demand in one particular price of the in one particular part of the world, you might temporarily get a premium price building up there. And that's exactly what has happened in Hong Kong recently. So that's kind of proof for your theory there, that Bitcoin, as you say, I mean, you know, if you're trying to transfer money out, if you're transferring in normal fiat currencies, then there is a chance that you're going to be spotted, not just spotted. Maybe the authorities would take a very serious interest in you. But if you know the right ways to trade cryptocurrencies in a private and cloaked fashion, then it could be a very useful way of getting money out of China and Hong Kong. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've just seen. Sorry, this is completely unrelated, but I've just seen the headline of the day: gay cake row referred to highest European court. Just like the gay cake.
Is that still going on? The gay cake row.
Apparently,
like,
yes.
It's decades now.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, what's your thought? Anything happening in the world of crypto? Should we look out for? Are you short? Are you long? Are you in the middle somewhere? What's happening?
Well, I have an update for you on my personal tradings. Yes, Justin, because the last time we spoke, and I actually had to listen back to our last podcast to remind myself of what I'd said.
Oh,
because
don't do that. Don't do that. Listen back. Never listen back to stuff.
No, I had to listen back because I suspected that that I'd been telling you about. I vaguely remembered having been telling you about how I just bought Bitcoin. This was at the beginning of August, was the last time that we spoke. And indeed, I had just bought Bitcoin on a breakout from a nice trend line that I'd identified. I had told you about how the price of Bitcoin has been in a correction since late June when it hit 14,000 and has been just moving its way slowly downwards ever since then, as you would expect after a quadrupling in price. And that's what I said, that it was a kind of a normal development as far as I was concerned, and not a crash per se. And I had bought at this trend line, and I had already made a small profit by the time I spoke to you. And I said what I was going to do was hold on to it in the expectation that this would be the big boom that would, you know, make me an absolute fortune. But being the kind of trader who trades with the trend, I was quite prepared for that rise to just be part of the correction that was going on, but still worth trading because, of course, you can get a 25% or 30% rise just during the upswing in a correction for Bitcoin. Those are that's the kind of volatility we're talking about. So I was quite prepared to sell if it turned out to just be part of the correction. And that is, in fact, exactly what transpired. So, you know, I've got a graph in front of me and I'm looking at how I bought it at about 9,700 beginning of August. I followed the price all the way up to higher than 12,000. So that's a pretty large percentage rise for just a couple of weeks. And as it started to falter, I saw, yep, I think this is just part of the normal correction. It's probably going to go back down. So I did that swing trader thing of selling near the high, and I made a pretty large profit.
That's why you're. That's why you write a book. I know. You sound very pleased with yourself.
I am.
So I'm excellent.
Like what I want. Well, what I wish would happen all the time, but sometimes your dreams kind of come true temporarily.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Basically, you saying. So what I did there was I bought at the low, sold at the high. Fantastic. Made a huge profit. I'm excellent. Read my book on how to do it. Job done. Yeah, but do you know what?
As you say, though, quickly, the price is heading back down again.
It is. Again, I'm seeing a series of lower highs there. You had that one, let me say, the 13,000. I'm looking at daily chart, 13,000. That was on the 26th of June. Then we had one at 12,500 at 9th of July. We've had one recently now at 11,900. And that is grinding lower. But seems to be a support line around about 9,360s in there, so it's touched that today.
It has,
but
yeah.
If it comes, I think it's great. I mean, you know, you've got the MACDs rolling over, you got the RSI grinding lower. I think this was like a semi peak again, and I don't know where it's going back down to now. Where's it headed? I mean, it could be down to where did it go last time? I mean, what was the big fall last time?
I'm out of it right now because so I'm kind of happy for it to fall lower temporarily.
Do you have a short?
I don't have a short in place. No, because it's still within this trading range, and I didn't really feel comfortable going short while it's still kind of within a range. If it was in a proper long-term crash and I was convinced of that, then yeah, I would certainly consider a short. But yeah, if you look at it on a sort of longer term graph going all the way back to, say, the beginning of 2019, it still kind of counts as a correction within that long uptrend that's been going on this year. Now, you know, as you say, if it goes below the support level at around about 9,000, then we'll start to have to reassess that and say, actually, is this the end of that bull trend that's been going on this year? But as I say, you know, for my trading personally, I'm out now, so I don't care.
But do you know what? There's no, I'm saying this is support level here. There's no lower lows, so it may be just consolidated there. But I think this is turning from now a sort of semi uptrend to a bit of a downtrend again. It's going down. I think it's going down, man.
By this time next week, when I next speak to you, I think we will know one way or the other. This is crunch time now.
We've got the 50-day moving average. Rolling over. When that happened, last time that happened, like I said, it was when it was 50-day moving average. When it was an uptrend, it started rolling over. That was when the last time that happened was when a big sell-off happened. You know, it got down from 20,000 down to say 14,000. That rolled over, and like I said, it grinded lower for a while. But we'll see with the internet. I mean, any other cryptos you're looking at, or are they all? They don't also reflect Bitcoin, do they?
I mean, they all still are pretty much at the moment. I mean, you get the odd one that bucks the trend for a short period of time, but the magnetic attraction of Bitcoin still is kind of dragging them all in. So when I'm long Bitcoin, I tend to look at other cryptos as well, and sometimes buy some temporarily. But when Bitcoin is grinding lower and I'm out of Bitcoin, I tend to be out of pretty much everything else as well. It has to be an incredibly attractive trend to sort of suck me in if Bitcoin itself is trending lower. That's generally the way I look at it. Though, as I've said before, I think that's a kind of temporary situation, well, a long-term temporary situation, in the sense that ever since the 2017 crash, that's pretty much been the case, that they all follow Bitcoin. But that, of course, won't be the case forever. It wasn't the case during parts of the 2017 boom. For example, towards the end of the boom, when I had sold my Bitcoin because I had decided that it had reached its peak, I was actually still in a lot of other cryptos for about a month or two, because a lot of them were sort of way behind in that sense. They were still booming while Bitcoin was crashing. So, you know, like with other assets, remember, it's the same outside crypto as well. You get temporary correlations between whole groups of assets, don't you, in the stock market or wherever else, and they all follow each other for a while, and then everybody gets comfortable with that, and that's when traders get kind of wrong-footed, because they all think, oh, well, all these stocks move together, and then suddenly everything changes. And they lose their correlation completely, and people get in all kinds of trouble in those situations. Likewise, in crypto, the correlations could end at any time, so I'm always kind of aware of that.
Yeah, cool, marvelous stuff. And anything else on the regulatory front, or any news on Bitcoin, anything at all this week? Or
There's been one or two things, nothing to get too excited about, but in terms of Britain, I'm slightly worried, because Barclays has reportedly severed relations with Coinbase, which is the world's biggest sort of crypto, or the best, most known crypto investment company, and one of the most respected, because it's based in America, it has regulation and all the rest of that kind of thing. And this hasn't been confirmed yet, so it's still a sort of in the stage of strong rumor, I'd put it. But Barclays seems to have severed, so we're told, its relationship. Santander, I'm also hearing things about, and I have personal experience here, because I've got a Santander bank account, and when I try and put money in Coinbase, it's incredibly difficult. They You know how, you know, when you transfer money, say online, say if you transfer a large amount of money to somebody you don't usually transfer money to or a company, they might start flagging it up, and then you have to type in an OTP, you know, the thing that they send to your phone, the one-time code, and there are all kinds of security mechanisms, some of which are fair enough. But then I've had payments still rejected by Santander, even after all of that. And I've just been reading about how other people have been having the same experience. There was an article about it. And you know, I speak to them on the phone and they say, yes, well, we have to be careful because this is a cryptocurrency company. Are you sure you meant to do it on purpose? You're not being scammed. And of course, people are scammed all the time on fake Bitcoin investments. Yeah. And we probably all get emails advertising these fake crypto investments and so on. But Coinbase is, as I say, a very well-established international company. So it just seems odd that banks are still so behind in kind of understanding the difference between a scam that they need to warn people about and a legitimate company that is fair enough to be dealing with.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's odd that I got a friend that texted me the other day, said, is this real? And he sent me it's like a fake article of Gordon Ramsay standing next to a Ferrari and something like saying, basically, a newspaper sort of style article saying, I've given up, you know, I've still do cooking and all that stuff, but I'm really into this trading. This earned me a lot more than my cooking, you know? And he said, Is this real? And he's a sharp guy. He's got a good job. And he had a picture of him, and even had a sort of a snapshot of a video, and a caption on the video said, telling this morning, you know, the TV show This Morning, about his new trading thing. And he said, anyone can do it. And he was clicking onto a link and then sign up. And it was quite plausible, but I thought, are you kidding? I said, Gordon Ramsay doesn't need to earn money. He's not a trader. He's a multi-millionaire. Why would he start doing trading? You know, nothing about just to earn more money. He's not in it for the money. I mean, he's in it probably for the ego and the fame and being well-known and renowned as a world-class chef. But he's not going to flip to trading straight away. Because it's so easy, even the most, intelligent people, you know, very level-headed people, are swayed by these kind of scams.
They are. Right. I mean, I've seen loads of those kinds, exactly like the ones you're talking about. I talked about them in my book, in fact, because Martin Lewis famously...
That's right, he took them to court, didn't he? Yeah,
he was really annoyed with Facebook that they kept... you know, he'd tell them about the scams and they'd obviously stop those particular ads, but then more of those kind of ads would appear. And they were always based on, Martin Lewis says, on This Morning, just like they always use This Morning, like the Gordon Ramsay one.
Yeah.
And I had a David Walliams one that I put in my book as well. You know, David Walliams has made a lot of money writing children's books, but now it's all about Bitcoin for David, thing.
Why would anyone do a 360 one to just completely different kind of career path, and but people are sucked in by it. But I mean,
they're often very convincing. Look, a lady wrote to me just the other day saying, and this is a woman who has actually read my book, and I have literally a couple of chapters about scams, so it's, you know, every warning is there, and yet she was still taken in, and she explained it to me in detail, and I can understand why, because the problem in the crypto world, that you might have heard of things called airdrops, where basically you get some free cryptocurrency sent to you. It's usually a kind of promotional thing, a marketing thing. And quite often the cryptocurrency that you get sent is worth pennies, you know, it's worth virtually nothing. But then, because everybody knows that that is a thing, then sometimes people come along and say, you can make some serious money. If you send us some of your Ethereum, say, to this address, then we will send you back 10 times as much Ethereum. It's our special Ethereum giveaway. And Twitter in particular is plagued with these things. And they're very, very convincing, because not only do they have somebody saying, if you put your Ethereum here, you go to this website, and the website is very convincing and all the rest of it, but also they will have dozens of people replying to their tweet, and all the people replying going, yes, I've just done it. Thanks so much. I've got this money now. And those people all look really genuine as well. But if you go into their Twitter profile and check it out more carefully, you can see that it's just, you know, somebody has basically stolen somebody's face and somebody's entire profile and made it look like these are all genuine people. But because there are dozens of these contributors replying, saying, yeah, it worked for me, and giving a thumbs up, it just seems like, well, this can't be made up then, because there are so many people replying, but they're all fake. It's huge. It's like the sting, you know. It's
like those guys on Westminster Bridge. Have you seen those guys that do that trick under the hand of the, what's under the hat or something? Or they've got three little thimbles, or whatever, three little cups. The three cup trick, or the shell game, yeah. And they're quite swarthy, so Eastern European looking at guys, but people come up and pay them, and these people win. Wow, that's amazing. But the people playing the game look like Eastern Europeans as well. And it's amazing how, surely the person winning this money couldn't be a mate of theirs, surely. And if you come along, it's easy to win. You generally will lose. I know, it's a scam. It's like, it's the old adage, isn't it? I mean, I love cliches, ring true, and they stay around, they hang around because they have a ring of truth to them. And I mean, that old adage, if it's, I can't even think of the thing, if it looks better than it is, what's it? If it's better than you think it is, it's too good to be true, it is. You're right.
I mean, because
I even forgot that cliche.
Shell game. Yeah. I mean, it's an age old trick, isn't it? You've just reminded me that it's kind of like the 19th century with snake oil sellers. They'd come in the street with their stupid potion, and they go, this will cure everything. And of course, they've planted a few people in the audience who then claim to be cured by it. So it's really no different from that. It's just the kind of Twitter equivalent.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Glenn, thanks for chatting, and we will catch up next week. Who knows where the market will be. So do you have any long positions at the moment or not?
In cryptocurrency?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I've got plenty of long positions still in stocks and futures. I'm long gold as well, so I've been doing really well out of that as the gold price rises. In cryptocurrencies, no. I am now, as of a few days ago, I am out and just sitting on the sidelines patiently, because it's important to be patient with these things.
That's one of the hardest things.
Just waiting for the right time to get back in. Yeah, it is, because you're always kind of... That's actually why it's quite useful to trade other things as well as cryptocurrencies. And I try and encourage people to, get a bit of diversity, because otherwise, there are times when you should just be out of cryptocurrencies for months and months at a time. And anybody who's only trading crypto is going to get pretty bored and get itchy trigger fingers. So it's good to have your eye on other investments as well at the same time.
Yeah, well, some people say, the hardest thing is doing nothing, and it is, because we are, as humans, we are sort of hardwired and, to do something. We've got it's billions of sort of chemical reactions going on in our body. We have a twitching and itching to do something. So sometimes sitting there and doing nothing is what you have to do, but it's very hard to do it. But,
exactly.
I mean, Warren Buffett says that famously. That's how he's earned his most money, is by doing nothing,
Exactly. I mean, he's the king of that. He's amazing at doing nothing.
He's done nothing. He's won billions, lazy sod. Anyway, marvellous, Glenn. Catch up next week.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies. They are at five, Safestay, SSTY. At four, Richland Resources. That's RLD, up 61%. At three, it's TLA Worldwide, up 10%. At two, Bidstack, down a little bit, 4.5%. Was a big sell-off today. Number one most followed companies, Itaconics, ITX. Up 9.68%. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Edison Investment Research Limited. Edison issues outlook on hurricane energy. So it's obviously a hurricane energy base there. Thor Mining, initial copper resource estimate at the Munta project. At three, Jangada Mines, disposal of Pedra Branca project. At two, Encondesi Energy, Holdington Company. And number one is Europa Metals, of course, drilling update. And I spoke to Lawrence on the podcast today. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.